Welcome to Strong Tower Radio Today. The views and opinions expressed on this show do not necessarily reflect the views of Strong Tower Radio, West Central Michigan Media Ministries, or its employees.
Hello and welcome to Strong Tower Radio Today. It's Garden Guy Week, and so we've got Gary Heilig, the Garden Guy. Welcome, Gary.
I'm happy to be here at home, although I'd rather be up there at the station.
You're doing a little bit of convalescing, you've told us.
Yeah, I fell on the ice and really whacked my kneecap pretty well, so I'm hobbling around.
Well, we'll probably get several...
Yeah, you now have a hitch in your get-along, as my friend Karen says.
Yeah, probably a couple of hitches. But it is getting better.
Well, we're going to ask our listeners to send you sympathy cards. So, anyway, we got Sue Majeure, and so Gary's in Eaton Rapids. That's a suburb of Lansing, Michigan. And Sue is in Kalamazoo. Actually, she's in Hickory, the large metropolis of Hickory Corners. Now, if you haven't been to Hickory Corners, Sue, you might want to describe that growing metropolis.
Well, there's a gas station C-store, and they've just changed brands, and they're putting up their sign today. And if you stop, and then you start, you've already been through the metropolis.
It's a one sign town or something.
There's a
like
one four-way stop here, and that'd be it.
That's right. It also had the notoriety at one time of having an independent phone company that happened to be the most expensive in the country.
And before that, it was a stagecoach stop.
That's true. And my grandparents had the Hickory Corner Exchange and at Gull Lake. And my younger years, they had a switchboard operator. Or they had not a switchboard, but they had party lines. Yeah, into my youth.
Tom, are you trying to avoid the quiz?
Oh, yeah. Well, that wasn't first on my mind, but it is quite a quiz there. It's about spices. Now, about all I know about in spices, Gary and Sue, is what I see in the supermarket there on the baking good aisle. And I know McCormick and the house brand is of either Food Club or Kroger's is about the only thing I know about spices, so I'm going to have to rely on my sister to be the spice expert today.
Well, if you cook with them a bit.
Okay, you guys want to have prayer first?
And we will. Started? We will. So, Sue, would you lead us in prayer?
All righty. Heavenly Father, thank you that we can get together and broadcast and talk to all of your people, or as many as we can reach. And since you use nature so often to illustrate the kingdom of heaven and to teach us, it's good that it's still here and that we can use it, and that the spring is coming that we're all eagerly looking forward to. So thank you for those blessings. In Jesus' name, amen.
Amen. Amen. Well, Gary?
Okay, so... Yeah.
I want to ask you a question. Where do spices come from?
They come from all over the world.
Okay.
And we'll talk a little bit about some of those. So the first question is, which spice comes from the dry stigma of a flower? And the stigma is the female part. And is the most expensive spice in the world?
Oh, Tom, you should know that one.
Uh-oh. Apparently, I don't. Go for it, Sue.
Oh, I thought you knew that because we've talked about it.
Well, I don't remember. Probably so. All I can think, the only spice I can think of is cinnamon. So
it starts with a N. And it comes from a crocus plant.
An autumn blooming crocus. And it looks like a tiny dark red thread. But when you put it in hot water and it blooms, turns it red or orange or bright yellow, and it's used in maybe you've seen saffron rice. That's quite popular.
Mm-hmm.
And it has an interesting flavor. It's used in paella too for cooking. I've had it. I went to a little town in Wisconsin that prides themselves. It's called Mineral Point, and they have quite a Cornish history because there were mines there, so they imported a lot of Cornish miners. And they brought with them their recipes and so on for saffron buns and saffron cake and saffron bread. And so if you go there, there's like a little inn that you can get some with clotted cream to try. I was lucky enough to try it, and it's some good stuff.
And the answer is what, Tom?
That's
She's only said it three or four times.
Yeah, I was going on to the next question.
you can't skip off of that like that.
Okay, here's the next question, multiple choice. What common spice is known as the queen of spices? A, cinnamon, B, black pepper, C, cardamom, or D, nutmeg?
I'm going to say black pepper. It seems like that's a staple that if you know no spice, it's pepper.
What do you think?
I'm thinking nutmeg because you got several spices out of it, and they had wars between like the Dutch and the Portuguese over it.
It's actually cardamom. But nutmeg is very important. We'll come back in a little bit. Okay, which spice is the primary ingredient in traditional yellow curry flour, also known for its anti-inflammatory properties? And your choices are saffron, ginger, cumin, or turmeric?
Turmeric.
Turmeric, yeah. Turmeric is it. Did you get that one, Tom?
I was going to go for saffron.
Well, I did say it was yellow. I bet it could make yellow. See, you've got to pay more attention to Brenda when she's talking about kitchen things, you know, how she talks about anti-inflammatories and making sure you get your turmeric supplements. You got to listen to those things a little more.
Yes.
Okay, the next one is, what is the name of the chemical that gives chili peppers their heat? Is it piperin, curcumin, allicin, or capsaicin?
Capsaicin.
What do you say, Tom?
I say capsaicin because my sister read a book on spices and peppers.
Trading that. That was a good book.
Yeah.
Precious cargo.
Number five. Which spice is obtained from the bark of a tree? Cloves, nutmeg, cinnamon, or cumin?
Cinnamon.
That's right. And one of the best cinnamons is Saigon cinnamon. I love that.
Oh, now we heard that it was the Ceylon cinnamon was supposed to be had the most anti-inflammatories in it.
Well, I'm thinking about flavor. I'm not thinking.
I see what you're saying. But they're all thinking about, you know, like your blood sugar because cinnamon does do that. So
yes, it does. And you know why I know that? I actually did a test. I called it the donut test. What I did was I bought two donuts, same kind, and then I put cinnamon all over one and not cinnamon on the other one. And so what I did was I measured my blood sugar after eating the donut at 15 minutes, 30 minutes, 45 minutes, an hour, and it decreased it quite a bit. So it does work. Now, the donut probably wasn't the best thing, but I knew the sugar would make my blood sugar go up, so I tried it using that. Okay, the next one is, what spice is often used in holiday baking and is derived from the seed of an evergreen tree? The choices are ginger, nutmeg, allspice, and star anise.
I'm going to say star anise because I don't think those other ones are. I mean, they don't sound like they came from an evergreen tree to me, but...
Well, evergreen doesn't necessarily mean pine.
Well, I know, but, they're not deciduous. They don't drop their leaves and stuff, but...
Yeah.
What are the choices again?
It was ginger, nutmeg, allspice, star anise.
But star anise doesn't sound like something we do much in the baking. Maybe nutmeg. Let's go with the nutmeg.
Yeah, nutmeg. Number seven, which spice commonly used in Italian and Middle Eastern cooking comes from a tiny dried berry? Is it sumac, cumin, black pepper, or fennel?
I want to say sumac because of za'atar, you know, and that has a lot of sumac in it. I actually quite like it when I try it, but I don't know if that's
really
the right answer.
It's because
they're tiny round. Okay, I'm going to take a leap of I'm not quite sure and go with za'atar or the sumac.
Tom?
I don't have a clue. I'm going to have to sit this one out.
It's actually black pepper.
Really?
Is it
a berry, yeah. Okay, next one. What is the main spice in traditional chai tea that gives it a warm, slightly sweet flavor? And I'll give you a hint on this one. We've already talked about the spice once. And the options are anise, cinnamon, cardamom, and clove.
Well, let's go with maybe the cardamom.
That would be correct.
Yeah, my friend Dave really likes chai tea a lot.
You ought to get this one, Tom.
Okay.
Which spice gives mustard its bright yellow color? Is it saffron, turmeric, curry powder, or cumin?
My favorite is saffron.
You need to get in the kitchen more.
Yeah, I know.
it's turmeric. Okay.
Yeah,
you can learn this stuff from the internet, too, because there's a whole series of things called How Things Are Made.
Mm-hmm.
And you can just go on there and say, how do you make mustard? And turmeric is big deal.
I know that.
Okay, number 10, which spice is often paired with nutmeg in baking and comes from the same plant? Is it allspice? Is it cloves or is it ginger?
Mace. I take that back because the one is like the shell on the inside and the other one's like the inside. I'm going to go with mace.
You're correct. And we'll talk about mace in a little bit. Number 11. What spice is commonly used in Mexican cuisine and is known for its earthy, slightly bitter taste? Is it oregano, paprika, cumin, or coriander?
Coriander. I keep wondering what cumin is there. Are you meaning cumin? C-U-M-I-N?
Americans usually say cumin, and Mexicans usually say cumin.
Interesting.
But you're right, it's coriander.
Well, coriander goes by several names depending on whether you're doing the seed or the leaves or whatever.
If I remember correctly, the cumin is the seed and coriander is the fruit.
Yeah.
Okay, number 12. Which of these spices is known for helping with digestion and is often chewed after meals in India? Is it cinnamon, fennel seeds, cloves, or nutmeg?
Anise.
That's not one of the choices.
Whenever I've been to, they have they have fennel sometimes because of the anise flavor, but fennel or anise seed, and sometimes they have like a little coating, so they look like funny little colored sunflower seeds, but you're right, but they have a very pleasant taste when you chew on them.
Mm-hmm. It's fennel. Fennel has kind of a licorice flavors type to it.
They used to call that meeting house seeds because their meetings would go on all day and people's stomachs would start rumbling. So to keep them quiet, they chewed on the fennel seeds, so they call them meeting house seeds, I hear.
I don't know. I haven't heard that. Okay, number 13, which spice is used to flavor licorice and has a distinctive sweet taste? Is it nutmeg, anise, caraway, or star anise?
That'd be anise.
And I'm going to go with anise.
Tom?
Likewise.
It's actually the star anise.
Oh, is it?
Yep, and they're different plants. Okay, which spice is known to be the king of spices and once was more valuable than gold? I probably don't even have to give you choices here.
See, now I would have picked pepper because that was one of the most important spices, and actually the places that sold
right.
place, Yeah, they would call it peppers.
That is right. Pepper, black pepper is the answer.
They used to have guilds of peppers, too.
What?
Here's your last question.
Sure.
Which spice is often used in baking, native to Indonesia, and is commonly associated with pumpkin spice? Is it ginger, mace, clove, or vanilla? And there was a chewing gum by the name also.
I think we're going to have to go with clove.
Yeah, clove is what
Tom?
Clove.
Yeah, that's right. And there's a, you remember in the movie The Right Stuff, Chuck Yeager, you say, got any Beemans? Beemans, cloves, and one other gum were three gums that used to be available. You don't find them so much anymore. But
Teaberry, wasn't it?
Teaberry was the third one, yeah. They were very different flavors. I don't know if you can still get them or not.
I don't know. I think there are some things you can still order online. Like, remember there used to be that rainbow-colored striped gum?
Mm-hmm.
It had a zebra on the package.
Is that juicy?
Was that fruit stripe gum?
Yeah, something like that. I think you can still get it on the Internet.
Yeah, I used to love that gum. I remember it because when I was in first grade, I had an operation at the hospital, and then when I finally got out of my room, I went down to the common room where the kids had toys and everything, and some little kid asked me if I wanted some fruit stripe gum, and that's when I started chewing it, and I really liked it.
There was also that if you wanted to go cinnamon, you know, thinking of spices, remember Big Red?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I don't know if you can buy that in the store anymore, too, but if you really wanted cinnamon gum, that's what you got.
Yeah, that was better than Dentine.
Mm-hmm.
But I love Dentine, too. So how are we doing on time?
We got about 1 minute. I have a question. How, you know, black spice is very common. We've, here in the United States, seems like we've opened up our palate to various spices more lately, but, you know, on every table at a restaurant had salt and pepper, which I assume comes from black pepper. How did it, if it was so valuable at one time, now it seems that black pepper is very, very common. Is there a story behind that?
Well, you have to realize that they had to go a long distance to get it. And they had, and that was one of the reasons Columbus went out. He was trying to find a new route to the areas of the world, which was India and places like that, where they had those spices. And, of course, it was just very expensive to go those trips to get those things.
So it's transportation.
And if you were a king, a lot of times a subtle way, maybe not so subtle, but showing that you were the king and you had the power was you invited, you know, diplomats or other kings to a big state banquet, and you put spices in everything. When I looked at some of those medieval recipes, some of those I'd think, why would you put that together? Or why would you put that? But it turned out that the more spices that you could put in the meal so that they had to smell them and eat them, everything, impressed upon them that you were very rich and very powerful if you could ship that much spice and afford it.
And I'm sure they were playing around with the new flavors to see what would go together. Because these
the Romans used to put rose petals in their apple pies.
Well, yeah, same family.
Well, there.
And roses are used by various cultures today, especially in the Middle East.
Well, we have come to the end of our first segment, and we'll be back after this break. You're listening to Good Growing with the Garden Guy with Gary Heilig, Sue Majeur, and Tom Majeur. We'll be right back.
This is Ruthie Calkins from Tustin. The Bible tells us that heaven will be the dwelling place of God's friends. That's why I'm so excited about supporting Strong Tower Radio. Their unique blend of thought-provoking speakers, stirring inspirational messages, and heartwarming music reaches into the lives and hearts of each listener, helping them to develop and cherish a friendship with God. If this radio station has been a blessing to you and your family, why not join me and hundreds of others in supporting Strong Tower Radio with a financial gift? They're 100% listener-supported and could really use your help right now. You can send your check to Strung Tower Radio, Post Office Box 567, Cadillac, Michigan 49601. Or you can visit their secure website to use your credit card at strongtowerradio.org. Strong Tower Radio, where God's character is proclaimed.
We're back with Good Growing with the Garden Guy with Gary Heilig, Sue Majeure, and Tom Majeure. It's all about spices today. And the first segment was on a really tricky educational quiz talking about spices. And in the second half, it's more spices. And Gary, we're looking for quite an education. Anise, we already said anise, and there was some other pronunciation, cumin, or you said it differently in Mexico.
I said cumin. That's how they say it in Spanish. But what I wanted to do when I put together this quiz, I started looking at some of these things in a little bit more detail, and the first thing I thought about was cloves. And cloves comes from Indonesia, and specifically some islands, the Maluku Islands, which is in Indonesia. You can also get it from Madagascar, Zanzibar, and Tanzania. Those are some of the larger producers. You can get it from India and Sri Lanka and Brazil. So you get an idea that you have to be in a tropical area in order to grow this stuff. And cloves has a strong, slightly sweet taste, a hint of bitterness. And one of the things it does, it has a numbing effect on you when you eat a certain amount of it, because it has a high concentration of a chemical called eugenol. And so that's why people would get clove oils, and if they had a toothache or something, they put some drops of clove oil on it, and it would tend to numb it. So I thought that was kind of an interesting thing. And then when we talked about anise or anise, whichever way you want to say it, I asked the question about a particular thing that dealt with them, and they're actually two different plants. Anise is Piperonella, that's the genus, and it's in the parsley family, and it is found in the Mediterranean region in Southwest Asia. The star anise, and one of the reasons they call it star anise is when it's cut, it makes the shape of a star, and that's from the fruit of an evergreen tree in the magnolia family. So we're talking about two different families, the parsley family and the magnolia family. And the star anise you tend to find in China and Vietnam. Those are the two native places where that particular spice comes from. Then we had mace. And every time I think about mace, I think of the chemical that you spray in somebody's face. And this comes from a tree called Myristica fragrans tree. And that's the same tree that produces nutmeg. And the nutmeg part is the seed, and the mace is the outer covering that surrounds the nutmeg seed. I didn't know that until I did the research on it. I thought that's really cool.
And for the price of one.
Yeah, and so when they harvest it, that outer covering, they dry it until it turns a pale orange-brown color, and then you grind it up into a fine powder. And if you sell whole pieces of mace, they call them blades. So this one is grown in Indonesia also, but you can find it in Grenada, India, Sri Lanka, in the Caribbean, Indonesia. So it's, again, it's kind of a warm, slightly sweet flavor, and it's more delicate compared to nutmeg. Nutmeg, you know, will slap you in the face if it's fresh. And it does have undercurrents, hints of cinnamon, black pepper, and citrus. So totally different. And it's used in cakes and pastries and things. It can also be used in savory dishes like soups and stews and curries. And when people make garam masala, anybody that makes Indian food, that's one of the things that's in it. And you'll also find it in pumpkin pie spice mix. And it's used to flavor meats too, which If you eat meat, they put in sausages and various sauces and that type of stuff. Now, during our break, we were talking about black pepper and white pepper. It's equivalent to the difference between a red bell pepper and a green bell pepper. Same plant, same fruit, but a green bell pepper is what we call a mature pepper, and the red bell pepper is a ripe pepper, or it might be purple or yellow or orange or brown. And it's the same thing with the black pepper that we see on the table. The black pepper is the mature form, and then the white pepper is the berry once it's allowed to completely ripen. And they have two totally different flavors. Like the white pepper is used a lot in Chinese food and Indian food, but it's easy for you to overdo it. And when I was young, we weren't allowed to use the pepper at all. But as I got older, and especially once I had a chance to try pepper that you ground yourself, it really is special. And the interesting thing is that when it's ground coarse, because we have a grinder that you can set how coarse you want it, every once in a while you'll bite into one of those and this burst of flavor comes out of the pepper, and it's just such a pleasant thing to me. Now, also, we talked about cardamom a little earlier, and this is a seed of a plant from the genus Etteria, or Etteria, or another genus would be Amomum, I guess it is.
And umami?
No, it's not umami. It's A-M-O-M-U-M. So I guess it's Amomum. But anyway, it belongs to the ginger family, and I'm not even going to try to pronounce that one. But one of the things I learned when I was doing the research here is there's green cardamom and there's black cardamom. So the green cardamom is from the genus Etteria, and the black cardamom is from the other genus. And the green one is used in both sweet and savory dishes, but the black cardamom has a smokier, more intense flavor, and it's usually used only in savory dishes. And I thought that was kind of interesting. And it grows in the southern Indian forest and in Sri Lanka. And in India, there's three different places. It's Kerala, Tamil Nadu, and Karnataka, known as the Cardamom Hills.
Tom has been to the Kerala coast. He stayed there with friends. And he said that, you know, the lady would just go out in the garden and get their whole supper out of there. And I just wondered if she had, like, peppercorn plants or anything there.
I didn't recall.
Well, this is that. Where they were growing cardamom. I don't know if they were growing pepper there, but I guess they could since it's the same region. But the world's largest exporter is Guatemala.
Guatemala.
Yeah.
They transplanted a lot of those East Indian spices to the West Indies, didn't they?
Yeah, no reason why you couldn't, because if they're at the same latitude, they're probably going to have similar weather. So the only thing you have to be concerned about are the soils similar so that you'd have good quality growth. Evidently, they do in Guatemala for cardamom because they're the number one exporter. So, again, they're used in Indian dishes. It's used in chai tea and lots of other places. Now, the other thing I wanted to find out was allspice. I always thought allspice meant a mixture of spices, but it's not. It's the dried berries of a plant in the genus Pimenta. And it's also an evergreen tree, and it comes from the myrtle family. So if you've seen crepe myrtle, which is a plant that flowers, a tree that flowers in the southern part of the United States, it's the same family. But it's not a blend of spices, but it's called allspice because it resembles a combination of cinnamon, nutmeg, and cloves in terms of its flavor. And this one is also grown in Central America, the Caribbean, especially Jamaica. Jamaica is the world's leading producer of allspice. It's also grown in Mexico, Guatemala, and Honduras. I thought that was kind of neat. And it's essential in Jamaican jerk seasoning. And, of course, it's used in pumpkin pie spice blends and in mulled cider and different things like that. Also common in Middle Eastern and Mexican cuisines. And it does have some medicinal uses also, because it also contains eugenol, which is that pain-relieving properties.
So, you know, it's still used in some dental applications, like some cements and so on.
Since it has a healing effect, I don't see why not.
Yeah, and so that's that smell when people come into the dental office and they go, you know, smells like a dentist's office. It's actually the eugenol oil they're smelling.
Mm-hmm. Never thought about that, but yeah, this smells similar. So I thought that was kind of interesting to check out where some of these spices came from and where they're grown and things like that.
Well, Gary, it begs the question, I didn't hear any domestic locations where spices were grown. Can you explain that?
Well, it's primarily the climate, because as far south as you can go is Texas and South Florida, and it still gets cold down there, so those plants probably wouldn't survive.
Hawaii, maybe.
I mean, if you were on the, Hawaii probably could, but if you were on the very edge of the, as far as it goes down south, you might be able to grow it for a while until you got a cold winter, and then it probably wouldn't grow.
Are these, most of these, perennial plants?
Yeah, they are. Many of them are perennial plants, or they're trees and shrubs, so yeah, they're perennial. Also, another thing I want to tell you is right now on new videos I'm working on, I just finished my second video on designing flower gardens. And and I'm currently working on one on peonies and another one on dahlias. So those will be coming up in March.
Can you give us a little flavor of what the flower garden design?
Well, I talk about all the different things that you want to consider in constructing the garden in terms of texture of the plants, color combinations, how to lay out the garden in terms of plant heights and those types of things. So it's designed to give you the principles of how to design a garden. And it's less than 10 minutes long, so I think it's only about 6 or 7 minutes long, so you can get quite a bit of information very quickly. And I show lots of examples of the different things that we're talking about. Now, with the peonies, for instance, in the peony video, I talk about some of the nicest peonies to grow, and I have a couple of them that are good for fragrance, which, for instance, there's an herbaceous perennial called Festiva Maxima, and it has a strong, sweet scent. And there's another one that's called the Duchess de Demois. I guess it's not German, but French. And it's a creamy white one with a lemon scent to it. Both of these are white peonies that have the...
That sounds lovely, with the scents on it, because I have noticed the scent on peonies, but you don't hear about as much as you might, say, roses or something.
No. No, I don't know if we've talked about roses that have really good scents, but I'll try to... I'm going to be making a video on that, too, what roses to grow if you want the best scent, probably in March or April.
I think the scent's the most important part, and I know if you get it, at least most of the time when you get roses from the florist nowadays, they look beautiful, but they don't have any of that lovely scent.
Well, they're not really bred for scent. They're bred for the long stems, and they're bred for their shipping qualities, color, and all those sorts of things. And a lot of the scented roses would not last as long. But when you bring in a bouquet of scented roses, that scent will just fill the room, and it really has a calming effect on people. It's just really pleasant. I think that's one aspect of plants that a lot of people have forgotten about.
I would love to smell it again. I remember Tom bought Mother for her birthday one year. It's an old variety now, but it's it was kind of maybe not as long stemmed, but it looked kind of like Mr. Lincoln because it was a dark red. It was called Crimson Glory. and there was a little bush, and she painted it by the porch there. It always smelled good.
Yeah, we had Crimson Glory. I used to take care of the roses in the rose garden at Michigan State University, and Crimson Glory did have a nice scent. We grew that one.
And a little bit of...
But you don't find it much anymore.
No. I mean, there are new roses released over the years, and some of the really old ones fall out of favor for various reasons. Because some of the newer varieties, they have more blooms, and they're larger, and they're more disease-resistant. And so people like all of those things, but many times they forget that roses had really nice scents. And I like to have a mixture of different things. And I especially want to enjoy the scents.
I think that's one of the most important parts. If I was a person that had to work all day and I seldom got to be in my garden during the day when sometimes the sun brings out some of the fragrance of some of them, I think I would plant a night garden with moonflowers and other things so I could sit on my porch and sniff it while I was home.
You better have a good nose then.
Well, I know that macroflowers and some of those have... They bloom at night, or they have a stronger fragrance at night for the moths or whatever. That's what I would plant.
You know, that kind of gives me an idea to look up, do some research on it, is when does a plant or a flower give off its best scent? Is it early morning? Is it afternoon? Is it in the evening? So I'm going to do a little bird dogging on that, and I'll see what I can find out.
Well, that sounds
good. Well, it would
be
lovely, because that was about the only time and you could enjoy your garden after all that work, that's what I would pick, something that would have a good scent in the evening so you could maybe sit on the porch and enjoy the scent.
Mm-hmm. You still with us, Tom?
I am. So it's a good time to take a break, and so this is
okay.
Good. Growing with the Garden Guy. We'll be back after this break.
Hi folks, Jelaine Fenner here. I just want to thank you for listening to Strong Tower Radio. We value all your prayers and financial support, especially our monthly donors. To stay on the air and continue to proclaim the Three Angels' messages, we need more monthly donors. Any amount is greatly appreciated, $5, $10, $25, $50, and of course, we'd even appreciate a larger donation. You know Jesus is coming back soon. Many people are learning about his return. Please pray and ask God what kind of commitment you can do for Strong Tower Radio. And if you are already a monthly donor, won't you consider increasing your donation? You can call us at 231-468-2087 or mail a donation to P.O. Box 567, Cadillac, Michigan 49601, or go online to str.fm and click that donate button. Thank you for your support of Strong Tower Radio, where God's character is proclaimed.
We're back with Good Growing with the Garden Guy, Gary Heilig, Sue Majeure, and yours truly, Tom Majeure. We were talking about peonies and dahlias. Now, Gary, you said you didn't go into too much detail because you wanted them to take a look at your video, but give our listeners who may not be familiar with peonies and dahlias a little bit of taste test here.
Well, one of the things about the dahlias are they can be very small, only a couple of inches across with their flowers, up to the size of a flower that has a dinner plate. And there are numerous species of dahlias, and I didn't even realize there were so many different species of dahlias, and then within that group there many varieties. And whereas with peonies, you basically have three different types. You have the herbaceous peonies, then you have what's called the tree peonies, which are woody stems, and then you have the cross between the two, which are called Ito peonies, which is I-T-O-H. And peonies generally have nice, large flowers. They're usually about the size, some of them about the size of your hand outstretched. And the dahlias probably have a greater color range in terms of reds, oranges, yellows, and whereas the peonies, you'll see pinks, reds, there are some yellows. I don't think I've seen any orange peonies, but I won't say that they don't exist. But you'll have some yellow in some of them, like the middle of them may be yellow. And they have a very soft, delicate flower. Peonies tend to, they live quite a long time. Like the tree peonies can outlive the people that plant them. So if you go to some of these older gardens, you may see a 50-year-old tree peony or older. So they can hang around for quite some time if they're well cared for.
Do they need to be pruned much?
Not a lot of pruning. Basically, all you're going to do is cut off dead material because they're not a very vigorous plant in terms of filling up a lot of space. You'll see branches of wood, and then at those terminals of the branches, you'll have your flowers. But they're not a real thick plant compared to, say, the regular peonies, the herbaceous peonies. The peonies many times will have to be supported as well as dahlias, especially the ones that have very large flowers, or if they're double flowers, because both of them can have double flowers or single flowers. And but the dahlias are not hardy in the northern areas. So if you get way down in Florida and Texas and places like that, like zone 7 and 9 and those areas, then they can be grown as perennials. They'll come back yearly. But up here, you either treat it as an annual and replant the tubers every year, or you dig them up and store them during the winter months and then replant them in the spring.
So how big
can you tell us more about the relationship with ants and peonies?
Well, ants aren't a problem for peonies. Now, if there happen to be aphids on the plant, many times they'll be attracted to aphids because aphids, their waste material is called honeydew, and it tends to be somewhat sweet. And some ants actually will tend them like
they're like cattle or
like
something.
Little cows, yeah. And there may be some exudates that come out of the peony bloom that the ants are attracted to, too, but they don't do any harm to the plant at all.
Okay, I always wondered about that because, you know, like some people are like, oh, those terrible ants, they were trying to spray them. I'm thinking, I don't think you should do that.
Yeah, they don't really cause any problem, but the only time that I might want to do something is if I was going to bring some peonies in and I was trying not to bring ants in with them. But an ant being brought into the house is a temporary pest because they're not going to survive in the house.
Okay, because it seems like when they start, when the buds are out and they're about to open, they're always swarming with ants, and you're, I always kind of wondered about that.
Yeah, I suspect there's some kind of an exudate that's excreted as the plant's growing, or there's something about what it's emitting that attracts the ants to the top. I'd have to do a little double-checking, but that's most likely what it is.
What are the sizes?
So also, as we're getting into March, it's time to start pruning. And we've talked about fruit trees before. I'd still hold off on things like the apricots and plums, cherries. Those are the peaches. Those are the last ones you want to do. But pears and apples, you definitely could get going. But there are a number of different shrubs that you can prune. Now, if it's a spring flowering shrub, one that blooms before the beginning of June, then we normally would not prune that unless you were just taking off dead material because the flower buds are in place already and you'll be pruning off some flower buds. But there are a number of plants that bloom midsummer to fall that you would do your pruning in the spring just before growth starts. Like the Rosa Sharon would be one, or the panicle hydrangeas and the smooth hydrangeas. Those are late bloomers. Like the smooth hydrangeas are June to September. The panicle hydrangeas are the July going into the fall. Potentilla, it blooms early summer to fall, so that can be done in the spring. Elderberry is early to midsummer, so you can prune that if you want without losing flowers. Now, nine bark, it will bloom late spring, early summer. Depending on what cultivar, will depend on when you prune it, but you can prune that late winter, early spring. And lilacs, the lilacs will produce their flowers in the spring, but if you're just going in there to take out some of the taller stuff or dead branches, you can get that done in the spring too. Spirea, you can do some stuff, although that does bloom late spring, early summer. And serviceberry or amelanchier, you can do that in the spring also. Honeysuckle, some of the northern honeysuckles will bloom mid to late summer, so those can be pruned. Beautyberry, winter holly, farthingale, and let's see, buttonbush, and bottlebrush bush can be done. So all of those things can be pruned in the spring before growth starts, and that'll get you off to a good start. Now, there's lots of other things you can do, too. For instance, if you have blueberries and you need to do some pruning, this March would be the time to get that done, whenever the weather's good. If you have raspberries that you're going to cut back, like I talked about ever-bearing raspberries, they will produce two crops, one during the summer, that's the second crop, and then the first crop comes in the fall. But if you just want a fall crop, you can cut everything back right now in March, and everything that comes up will produce again late summer, early fall. And March, if the ground is amenable to you digging in it, then you can plant trees and shrubs as soon as you can get out there and work the ground. It's not going to harm the plants to do that. Now, if we have snow on the ground, which we can in March in Michigan very easily, and probably less so in Indiana, but we can still have quite a bit of snow during that time. But if for instance, our snow is melting right now, you can get out there and work it if the ground isn't totally frozen. And the same thing would be true for transplanting things, like if you're going to transplant shrubs or small trees or anything like that, that can be done in March. Cleaning up your perennial beds, if you didn't get around to it last year, cutting plants back and cleaning that out, beds against the house or out in the yard. Another thing I do is I keep my eyes open for the groundhogs. Last year I wasn't paying much attention, and I had a groundhog dig a burrow right next to our house. Yeah, that was not much of a
problem. They can ruin your foundation.
Huh? They can cause some problems, but I'll take care of them. But if you see him running around the yard, if you see Pulsatone Phil running around the yard, he may have a burrow somewhere nearby. And if you don't want him getting into your vegetable garden or chewing down your flowers, you might want to gas his den and get rid of him before he has a chance to procreate. And if you haven't cleaned up your vegetable garden, getting out there and getting the cages out and finish getting all the dead plants up and mulches, get the mulches turned under, although you may not be able to till this time of year because it can still be.
You know, bad. When you talked about staking the peonies, you know, the heavy-headed ones, because
mm-hmm.
a lot of times the big. And I saw these nifty things that they had like four legs coated metal and this grid, and you take them out before the peonies and or dahlias start really getting going and poke it into the, you know, the legs into the ground and let them grow up through that grid, and it's usually green, the coating, and it hides all that stuff underneath, but it holds up all the blooms so they look just great.
Yeah, not all of the plants have to have that, but if you have the taller ones with very big, heavy blooms, and that's very helpful. And I was just looking at some on Amazon the other day, and the one that I liked was like $40. But if you get a few every year or so, you can keep them for a long time since they are metal. And I am including that in my a picture of one in my video on the peonies, so you get a chance to see that. But, yeah, they're really nice. And, of course, March is prime time for getting your seeds in. There are many things that you could have started already back in February, but March is prime time for most stuff. So if you haven't started sowing seeds yet, you might want to get started on that.
You're talking about seeding in house, inside,
Or a greenhouse, yeah. You're going to have supplemental light, and if you have a greenhouse, you're going to need supplemental heat in March, but depending on the size of your greenhouse, it's doable. Because during the day, you won't have to have the heater on, because if we have sunlight, like, for instance, even in March, on a sunny day, my greenhouse will get over 60 degrees in it, and that's with no heat in it. So it's night that you have to be concerned about. And there are all kinds of little ideas on the internet for you to make little candle heaters and things, because depending on what you're growing in there determines how hot it has to be. So if you're growing cool season crops like spinach and lettuce and things to just consume, that's not quite the same as tomatoes and peppers, which really do better when the temperatures are up in the 70s and 80s. So take that into consideration. If you're growing certain flowers, perennials, they can handle 60 degrees or getting down into the 50s even without much trouble. So take those things into consideration. Also, this is a great time if you haven't started, start putting together your garden designs. One of the things I want to do this year is I have our garage is attached to our house, but there's a little breezeway in between. A planter box for shade-loving plants to put in between the house. And I think that would be really cool. So that's what I'm hoping to do this year. And then there are some things you can do to fertilize in March. For instance, if you were going to fertilize your bulbs, you want to do that just as they're beginning to come up. You can fertilize your blueberries and raspberries before growth begins. If you have new trees that like young fruit trees or ornamental trees that you want to give them a good start, that could be done in March too. Kind of lean more toward later part of March, depending on what the weather's like. And you can get those things done. And, don't forget your grapes too if you happen to have grapes. So you want to get those things fertilized. So there's lots to do in March because we're getting geared up for the growing season. Remember, the first day of spring is usually about the 21st.
Yes,
that is if it's not snowing.
Yeah, because there have been times when we've had snowstorms at the end of March, so it is very possible.
Yeah, April Fools.
But you still can get out and do some things even in the snow. You can still get out and do some pruning. You may not be able to plant, but I still have wood to clean up from the latest windstorm, so I'll be out cutting logs and getting firewood together and all that sort of stuff. You can still clean the garden up, too, to a certain extent. You may not be able to get everything up, but you can always make progress.
Every little bit counts.
Yep.
How do you fertilize bulbs? Is that surface fertilizer, or how do you go about doing that?
Well, it's much better to, in terms of cost, to use a dry fertilizer. Of course, organic fertilizers will cost you a little bit more. But it depends on what it is you're fertilizing as to what you use. For instance, some plants may require a lower nitrogen fertilizer. For instance, the peonies and the dahlias, they don't need high levels of nitrogen in the spring. So you might use a balanced fertilizer, or you might use a 5-10-10, or you can use an organic fertilizer, which releases its nutrients over a longer period of time. Another way you can determine how much to use and what to use would be to run a soil test. You might have some difficulty taking the sample in March unless the ground's not frozen. You only need to get down about 3 to 6 inches. So if the ground's not frozen and you can get to it, then you can take your sample, let it air dry in the house before you send it to the university. And then they'll give you the recommendations based on what you're growing as to what you might want to use for those particular crops. But most of the time, it's a balanced fertilizer that you're broadcasting over the plants. Or in the case of a tree, you're going to put it in a wide ring out by the drip line, which means where the farthest branches extend out to. That's where you want to put your wide ring of fertilizer, because that's where most of the feeder roots are.
That's good to know. Yes.
He would also ask him if there's anything to do much with to encourage their strawberry plants. Somebody gave them a lot of strawberry plants, and when I asked Brenda about it yesterday, she said that they had hardly got anything. And I said, well, were they mother or daughter plants? She said she didn't seem to know that they were just, the school had some extra, and they said, here. So she grew them, and I suspect they were mother plants, and they've done their bit. But you have to, because you get your crop the next year off of the daughter plants, don't you?
Well, the mother plant can produce about 3 or 4 years, and then they start going downhill. But, yeah, as the mother plants are going downhill, the daughter plants start to be more productive. And that's one of the reasons why we renovate a strawberry bed. And what we're doing when we renovate a strawberry bed, and this is done after harvesting, which is usually June, late June, and maybe even going into July, depending on what cultivar you're growing. And you mow them down, you mow the leaves off, but you don't cut up the crowns. And then you till to thin the row out. And then you, if you need to thin any more, then you go in and take out the oldest crowns. And as the strawberry plant gets larger, the crown gets longer. And they're fairly easy to identify. And you just dig those out so that the daughter plants have more room to grow. If you don't have a system where you manage that, eventually the plants will just get so thick that they're competing for the same water and nutrients, and the plants and the fruit won't be very large because there's just not enough room. The ideal spacing for a plant or between plants is 6 inches.
So is it? Could it be because they transplanted the strawberry plants that year that they weren't going to produce any strawberries?
Well, the first year that you transplant something, you need to let it grow vegetatively. And like you said, I don't know if they use daughter plants or not, but the plant has to get established and get some size to it before they can support very much fruit. And what we normally do when we plant strawberries is we take off any flowers up until about the first week of June so that the greenery grows. And then after that, if it's a June-bearing type, it'll produce its fruit the following season. If it's an ever-bearing type, then once you take the flowers off up until about July, then the plant's large enough to where it'll continue to fruit on into the fall, and you should get pretty decent crops in. But, of course, another thing that you have to consider is, are the plants being fertilized? What the fertility was of the soil where you put them? Did you give them sufficient water? Did they have to compete against weeds? Because weeds can take over strawberry bed very quickly. And strawberries don't compete very well against weeds. So there are a number of different factors that could account for that.
Wow, this good topic could go all day. So we're going to end this particular session for March and look forward to the April Good Growing with the Garden Guy with Gary Heilig, Sue Majeure, and yours truly, Tom Majeure, on the Strong Tower Radio Network. Until next time, good growing. Bye now.